Being a bit greedy when it comes to food, I grab one of the larger pieces. I try to bite off a piece, but no matter how I tried, my teeth made no impression on the muktuk. I finally put the whole thing in my mouth, thinking that in time I will bear it down small enough so I could swallow it. After chewing for what seemed an hour, I had to give up. I had not gained a thing on that chunk of muktuk. Being sure that no one was looking or watching me, I succeeded in removing the thing from my mouth. Then I stuck it under the reindeer skin I was sitting on. When it came time to go to bed, I was still in favor of setting up the tent, but the other boys were not inclined to leave the comfort of the igloo, as the outside temperature, even this late in the spring, dropped way below zero at night. There was not 10 persons in the igloo, the chief and his wife and son and two teenage daughters, and 5 in our party. There was no beds to make, as everybody slept on the floor. The Eskimos, including the teenage girls, all undressed stark naked in front of everybody, then laid down, covering themselves with deerskins. Having our own bedding, the offer of deerskin for cover was not accepted by us, as we had no intention of completely disrobing. The Eskimos at that time were using urine for tanning furs and skins, the urine therefore being saved in a large can. At night, a smaller can was provided for the use of and comfort of the people occupying the igloo. At night, serving two purposes, saving the tanning food and eliminating the discomfort of going out in the cold and also letting cold into the igloo. I awoke during the night, and as the moon was shining through the skylight of the igloo, it was quite light inside. I saw this can sitting close to my head. I also detected a strong odor of urine. On investigating, I found the can half full. Herb was sleeping a short distance away, and as I had no use for the can, I moved it quietly over next to his head. I fell asleep again shortly thereafter, and I was soon awakened by the darndest commotion in the igloo. Herb had awakened and seeing this evil smelling can next to his head, thinking it was a joke someone tried to play on him, threw the can and contents against the igloo wall, dousing the occupant of the igloo with the contents of the can. As it was close to morning and time to get up, we all got up and dressed. Herb apologized to the Eskimos for his action. I doubt if the chief would have invited us to spend another night in his igloo had this been necessary. The two sleds belonging to the Eskimos, being loaded with all the gear except what belonged to Herb and I, myself, Sandy and the other boys, left for Barrow. Having decided not to call at Beachy Point, as Beachy Point was located east of the mouth of the Colville River, it would be out of their way, therefore increasing the distance to Barrow. There was a good trail from the village to Beachy Point, and the Eskimos assured us that we would have no trouble at all arriving there safely. As they still had a few scrub dogs left in the village, a native boy at the last minute, offered to go along with us to Beachy Point. He also took along a few fox furs for barter, at the village having helped us with some of their supplies. They needed additional supplies. Stanley had tried to pay for the help given us, but the money was refused. When traveling in the Arctic, the following observation may be due to the dry atmosphere or to the angle of the sun's rays hitting the earth in the Arctic. Everything magnifies. Often, when traveling, an object will loom up as big as a telephone pole, and later, when reaching the spot, it will turn out to be a tall blade of grass or a small willow. Often we could swear that we were approaching a building and discover it to be a not too large chunk of clear ice. It gives a person a creepy feeling, and one often wonders if everything is all right and as it should be in one's upper story. It makes a fellow traveler feel a lot better when the other fellows in the party experience the same illusion. There's a story of an early explorer in the Arctic discovering a large island miles long in the polar region. His observation and discovery was taken on board a ship. Longitude and latitude were correctly taken. His findings plotted and printed on a real early map. I believe it was called Keenan Land. Later, explorers at exactly the same location as the land was plotted and supposed to be upon 60 fathoms of water. The discovery apparently had been nothing else but a mirage. Before reaching the trading post at Beachy Point, we experienced many illusions similar to the ones that I have just described. We saw the house or the trading post at least a dozen times before our arrival. We received a most hearty welcome from Tony Edwardson and his wife at Beachy Point. Edwardson operated the trading post for Liebes Fur Company of San Francisco. Trading posts also owned by the same company being located at Barrow and at Wainwright. The store at Barrow was in charge of Charles D. Brower, and the one at Wainwright was run by the full name of Jim Allen. A large boat named the Charles D. Brower, owned also by the Liebes Company, supplied these stores and trading posts once a year. When the fur prices were high and the fur industry in its height, the Charles D. Brower often returned to San Francisco from the Arctic with a cargo often running well over $1 million, consisting of furs, ivory, and whalebone called baleen. Later, when the bottom fell out of the fur business, the company disposed of their interest in the Arctic, and the Charles D. Brower discontinued the Arctic run. A small number of individual traders between Point Barrow and Herschel Island held on for a number of years, even after this drop in fur prices, but finally had to give up as the ship would no longer resupply them and the trading posts due to the meager return in revenue. Another factor that contributed to the economy of the Arctic was the harvest of whalebone or baleen. When the ladies quit using the corsets and the buggy whip no longer needed, this industry also became a thing of the past. After the whaling ships discontinued their journeys into the Arctic in search of the bowhead and sperm whale, the Eskimos still carried on their yearly whale hunt to a limited degree, as they still are doing today. The whale meat and muskuk contributing a large portion to their food supply. The baleen also having some value, chiefly used in the manufacture of baskets and other trinkets to be sold to the ever-increasing tourists in Alaska. The trading post would barter for a small quantity of baleen during the spring whaling season, and then later resell the baleen to the natives when there was no whale obtainable, therefore no baleen. The whale hunting was carried on each spring by the Eskimos at the edge of the shore ice. A camp was established on the solid or ground ice. Unlike the whaling ships cruising the Arctic Sea, covering a large area in search for the whale, the Eskimos' mode of hunting on the ice shelf is therefore, in contrast, limited to the immediate or the visual area of their camp. If a whaling camp or party are fortunate to capture 3 whales in a season hunt, it would be termed as a good year. Having spent several days in the whaling camp at Point Barrow, one cannot help but marvel at the patience and determination of the Eskimo whale hunters. The trading post at Beachy Point consisted of a large wooden building, one good sized room being used as the store. There was also a large kitchen and one bedroom occupied by the Edwardsons. There was also a large attic over the store used for storing furs. The attic was reached by a ladder from the store. Herb and I were assigned sleeping quarters in this attic. Edwardson and his wife, being wonderful cooks and very congenial people, soon made us feel right at home. Tony told us later, after we had become reacquainted, that when we first arrived, he had never in his life laid eyes on 2 men as thin and miserably looking as we were. And he added, as filthy and dirty. I have often heard the saying that if a bunch of men live together and they're all filthy, one cannot detect the odor from his companions. But to the Edwardsons living in a nice clean house, our smell must have been almost unbearable. As we had slept in our clothes for 2 months and never had an opportunity to take a bath, Tony proceeded at once to heat a big tub of water, and by evening we were feeling like new men. Tony provided a razor, and we enjoyed the luxury of our first shave for a long time. Sandy had provided us with some money before he left for Barrow. We used this to purchase a complete change of clothing. our trail clothes being in such a bad condition that they could not even stand the washing, and we therefore burned them. Also, staying with the Edwardsons and having spent the winter at Beachy Point was a man by the name of Pete Grant. Pete was the owner of a small trading schooner named the Orion. During our stay at Beachy Point, I became well acquainted with Pete. He was just by the hour telling us about his experiences in the Arctic. Pete related that he had spent several winters along the Arctic coast as far east as Herschel Island. Having purchased the Orion at Nome some years before, loading it up with trading goods, he and a partner headed for the Arctic. His partner, having decided to make the Arctic his home, caused the two to split up, Pete buying out his partner's share in the schooner. When returning from the east late in the season of 1925, fighting ice all the way, the approaching winter made it necessary for him to pull the schooner out and winter at Beachy Point. He told us about the Caribou Eskimos. The Caribou Eskimos, as he told us, are the gypsies of the Arctic. Never having a permanent camp or home, always on the move, following the caribou herds. They live, according to Pete, entirely on meat and fish. Their clothing, dishes, and utensils are all made by them with their own hands. Pete said this tribe of natives were the most pathetic and destitute humans he had ever seen. In the summertime, they live in skin huts, and in the winter, in snow igloos. During our stay at Beachy Point, our activity consisted mainly of eating, sleeping, cooking, and feeding our dogs. We also had to exercise our team each day, giving them a short run. When feeding a dog, having been as close to starving to death as ours had been, extreme caution must be taken. If overfed and not given an exercise, some dogs will die. Others, if recovering, will never be of any value as sled dogs. This is probably due to their shrunken stomachs and lesser amounts of digestive juices. We therefore would feed lesser amounts to our dogs twice a day for the first 6 days, later feeding once a day. For fresh water, Edwardson's hauled ice from a lake a mile from the trading post. The ice had been cut early in the winter when about 2 feet thick. Later in the winter, the ice freezes to a thickness of 6 feet or more and is therefore too hard to handle and cut. The ice was stacked in a huge pile on top of the lake ice. This provided our team with the necessary exercise. A load of ice would be brought in from the lake every day. There was another small trading post west of Edwardson's place, and across a small bay, a distance of 3 or 4 miles. This is approximate distance, as no two persons ever agreed on the same distance. The trading post having been established by Captain Peterson, owner of a large trading vessel, making yearly trips as far east as Herschel Island every year, Before leaving the Arctic on his return journey to the States, Peterson would leave all his remaining trading goods at this place. Rather than carrying the goods back to San Francisco. When the fur catch to the eastward, this ferry, peak season, was good. The supplies left at this station did not amount to very much. Whenever this happened, Tony Edwardson would receive the bulk of the furs as his supplier supplied him with more of a regularity. The Arctic being no different in business competition than elsewhere, there was always a certain amount of jealousy amongst the traders, often to a point of not speaking to each other for years. And it never occurred to a competitive trader to make a social call on his competitor. One day Pete suggested that we hitch up the dogs and visit the store owned by Peterson, as during the winter he had not been able to do so. When we mentioned this to Edwardson, he at once tried to discourage us from going. Giving us a rundown of all the bad qualities and the terrible reputation of the man being in charge of the store for Peterson. Sorry, I have forgotten this man's name. Despite Edwardson's and against his wishes, we decided to go for a visit. The trip across the bay took less than an hour. We were surprised to see such a large store. The storekeeper was tickled to death to receive company, the only people he had seen or talked to all winter being natives. We spent several hours at this place, giving him all the news, this being limited as our media of news dated back several months. The summer of 1925 must have been a good fur year for Peterson, as the shelves in the store were practically bare. Having some coffee and making a few purchases of some odd items, we returned to Beachy Point. In our conversation with the storekeeper before we left, he never mentioned anything bad about anyone. Therefore, my belief is that some of the bickering, fighting, and jealousy in the Arctic often proved to be a one-sided affair. Having partaken of Edwardson's hospitality for a week, we were well rested. Our dogs, having received the best of care, looked like they were ready for the trail again. In the afternoon of the eighth day of our stay, someone spotted a dog team approaching the trading post, the team coming from the westward or Point Barrow way, causing me to think that it probably was one of the teams employed by Sandy and now returning from his trip from Point Barrow. This turned out to be incorrect, as the native driving the team told us his home was at Cape Halkett, some 50 miles west of Beachy Point. Needing some supplies, he had decided to take some of his furs and do some trading at Beachy Point, Point Barrow being a much greater distance from his home. When asked if he had seen anything of the two natives from Iqaluit, his answer was negative. When hearing that we probably would start for Barrow in a day or so, he offered to lay over an extra day. As we had no experience in Arctic coast traveling, the suggestion of him guiding us at least part of the way was therefore greatly appreciated and accepted. After telling him of our experiences on the trail and how badly starved our dogs had been before reaching the trading post, his thought was that we would not be able to travel as far as Cape Halkett or his home the first day, therefore would have to spend the night on the ice of Harrison Bay. His dogs being in good shape made the trip to Beachy Point in one day without showing too much exertion. Pete Brand told us he would remain with Edwardson until after the breakup, then proceed to Barra with his schooner. Pete told me a little of his past life, having followed the trade of a merchant sailor most of his life. He arrived in San Francisco from Sweden as a young man. After having sailed the seven seas on merchant sailing vessels, he decided to join the U.S. Coast Guard, being assigned to the Coast Guard Cutter Bear, flying the Arctic waters every summer. This gave him the urge to someday engage in trapping and trading in the remote Arctic. From the Cutter Bear, he'd asked for a transfer to the Coast Guard station at Nome. This was granted, serving several years under the Nome commander, Captain Thomas Ross. Finishing his duty with the Coast Guard, Pete ventured on trading missions along the Siberian coast and into the Arctic. Pete passed away 3 years ago in Seattle at the age of close to 90. As I have mentioned earlier in my story, we departed from Beachy Point 10 days after our arrival. The natives' prediction as to the stamina of our dogs proved to be correct. After a few miles, they were all in and down to a slow walk. We kept plodding along, the native finally transferring our load to his sled in order to make it easier for our team and gain a little speed. We camped on the ice that night, having covered about 30 miles, making a shelter from snow blocks with a canvas roof. And as the weather was nice and not too cold, we suffered very little discomfort. The next morning, the dog started out real slow, having become somewhat stiff or lame from our traveling the day before. And believe me, they had company. Herb and I having gained a lot of weight in 10 days and not exercised as much as we should, could hardly walk. We therefore appreciated the slow gait of the team, walking most of the time. After traveling a few miles on the trail, we then limbered up, as did the dog, arriving at Cape Halkett early in the day. The native invited us to stay with him. His wife prepared our dinner. After dinner, Joe, as we called him, I never did master the pronunciation of his other names. Having observed our flight on the trail, sat quietly thinking, not uttering a sound. When he did speak, it was to me the sweetest words anyone could have said. The trapping season is over, he said, and I have a lot of furs to dispose of. Watching you boys and your dogs in leaving Beachy Point, it is my belief that you boys will have a tough time reaching Barrow by yourself without running out of grub and dog food again. I'm curious that he made the statement, Herb and I were two of the happiest boys in the Arctic. The performance of our team being a lot better the following day, we covered quite a distance and could take turns riding the sled once in a while. From our first day out to the time we reached Barrow, there was a noted improvement in both our dogs and our progress. Having camped early one afternoon, we started to build our usual shelter using our sled covers for roof. As I had never seen a real snow igloo, I asked Joe why we don't build one. As Joe was agreeable, we started cutting snow blocks, Joe putting the blocks in place. When the igloo was finished, as nearly or nearly so, Bird moved some of the harsh gear inside, Joe and I using loose snow, filling the cracks between the blocks. I must have hit the top of the igloo quite a blow with my shovel, because the whole top and part of the sides caved in, burying Herb. When he emerged from the pile of snow blocks, he was using language that is unprintable, and making him madder was the fact that Joe and I almost split our sides laughing at him. Needless to say, our shelter for the night and every night till we reached Barrow followed the same old pattern of snow blocks for sides and canvas for a top. I might mention here that the Eskimos never used the snow igloo that you often see in pictures. This is merely for picture purposes, I guess. They always use the same type of shelter as we use on our trip. We arrived at Barrow on the sixth day after leaving Beachy Point. No other incidents worth mentioning having occurred. Before continuing the story describing the activities of the Detroit Arctic Expedition at Point Barrow, there are some parts of the narrative needing some clarification, if not to all the readers, to the readers having some knowledge of the Endicott Mountain and the river routes as well. Also the coastline east of Point Barrow to the mouth of the Colville River. I was often asked after my return to Nome from Point Barrow, why did Sandy Smith choose the Anaktuvuk River for his approach to the Arctic Ocean? When other passes through the mountain could be utilized, and by following a direct route, shortening the journey to Point Barrow by at least 200 miles. Sandy and I had discussed this subject many, many times during our slow and often seemingly impossible travel on the Anaktuvuk River. Sandy at one time disclosed the temptation of returning or turning around and trying another route, but having wasted much valuable time already, he considered that it would be a folly to alter his present plans. In our discussion, he revealed that prior to leaving Nenana, he had plotted the route of travel in the presence of Captain Wilkins. The route agreed upon was as follows. To proceed up the John River to a branch which he called the West Fork of the John River. This fork being close to the headwaters of the river, follow this branch to Chandler Lake, then locate a pass through the mountains on the north side of the, that's on the north side of the lake. After leaving the mountains, head in a northwesterly direction, crossing the Colville River near its headwaters. After crossing the Colville, the valley of the Chip River would then be followed to the coast. This would bring the expedition within 30 miles of Arrow. When Sandy arrived at Bettles, he disclosed his plan to some of the old timers and was thoroughly convinced that his proposed route was an impossibility. It would surely end in disaster and death for the party. One old timer informed Sandy that the Anaktuvuk route offered an abundance of caribou all the way to the coast, and that the problem of obtaining dog food would be solved by this, by the abundance of game this route was chosen. It is doubtful if the old timers advising Sandy had any knowledge whatsoever of the conditions or terrain of the Endicott Range, nor any conception of the area lying beyond. Hindsight being the basis for many people's criticism, Sandy was naturally blamed for the near disaster of the overland expedition. Having canceled their first plotted route, no one will ever know what the ultimate success of this undertaking would have been. I like Sandy a lot, a real hard worker on the trail, wiry and tough, often breaking trail ahead of the dogs or the dog team all day, suffering from bleeding, hemorrhoids. The discomfort must have been hell at times. But Sandy never uttered the complaint. Most of his Arctic experience, as he told me, had been gained in Siberia, prospecting for gold in the Anadyr and Lena River district. Once arrested as being a spy, all his belongings confiscated, he spent several months in the Bolshevik jail. Reading of his passing away some years ago at the age of 93, a newspaper stated that Alexander Smith had returned to Siberia after serving with the Detroit Wilkins expedition. I knew this to be untrue because Sandy had told me there was a reward posted for his arrest or capture, dead or alive, by the Bolsheviks. After breaking jail, he managed to sneak away on a ship and eventually return to Alaska, with absolutely no intentions of ever returning to Siberia. At Barrow, we found quarters in a building occupied by some of the expedition members. Charlie Brar provided for our meals. Brar operated the kitchen and dining room in connection with his store. Fred Hobson doing the cooking. Fred was a good cook and baker and a long-time resident of the Arctic, having arrived on a whaling ship in the early days. He settled at Barrow, marrying an Eskimo girl, and raised a large family. The meals at Barrow were served family style, and if you missed the regular meal schedule, you would have to wait till the next meal. Having missed many meals during the past couple of months, I was not about to be late. When serving roast and other large pieces of meat, Charles Barrow just followed the old English tradition of carving at the table, his place being always at the head of the table. When Captain Wilkins learned that we had not brought the cooler plant nor the radio equipment with us, he was far from happy, explaining the circumstances and reasons why we did not bring it, calmed him down to a certain degree. But for the first few days, there was a noted absence of friendliness towards Herb and myself. Wilkins, at the time, having his hands full with matters of greater importance, the incident of the coal plant and the radio equipment was soon forgotten. Wilkins and Van Nielsen had made three trips to Barrow in the single-engine Fokker plane, bringing a load of case gasoline each trip in order to have the supply on hand for the future flight over the polar ice. The two Fokker planes brought to Fairbanks early in 1926 were both wrecked badly on their first trial hop. Nielsen piloting the single-engine plane when coming in for a landing overshot the field and washed out the running gear and bending the propellers. In spite of this disaster, repairs were made and another propeller installed. Not being able to obtain the proper propeller in Fairbanks, the performance of the Alaskan, as the ship was called, was far from perfect. This did not stop Wilkins and Nielsen from transporting several hundred gallons of gas and other equipment to Barrow. Ben told me about his first trip, that he had never flown to Barrow before, nor anyone else, as far as that goes. In crossing the Endicott Range in an airplane, not performing as it should, was quite an experience. The path he flew through being so narrow, said Ben, that had they run into a dead end, it would have been impossible to turn around. Insert here a quote from Wilkins' book. After completing the reassembling of the trimotor Fokker, Wilkins, with Major Lamphere at the controls, suffered a much greater disaster on their first landing, completely dismantling the running gear, bending the props, and the center engine broke loose from its motor mounts. When Wilkins told me later at Barrow about the disaster, he said it looked like a total loss. Obtaining parts from the States and spending many weeks repairing the Detroiters, as this ship was now called, it was finally ready for its trial flight. While the trimotor was being repaired at Fairbanks under the supervision of Major Lamphere, Wilkins and Nielsen freighted the gas to Barrow. While storm-bound at Barrow on what was to be the last trip for the Alaskan, Wilkins received the disheartening wireless message that the Detroiters would not perform properly. When loaded, it would not climb high enough or to an altitude required for crossing the Endicott Range. This message, together with the continuation of the inclement weather upset Wilkins to a point that made him fit to be tied. As Ben described it to me later, the man walked the floor at the barrel store like a caged animal. The weather at Barrow having improved some, and under marginal flying conditions, they departed and reached Fairbanks without any trouble. When Wilkins arrived back in Fairbanks, he knew at once that something was wrong with the disposition and feeling of the men left in Fairbanks to repair and later to fly the Detroiters. Their attitude, described by Wilkins as having lost all interest in the success of the expedition, therefore did not give the Detroiters the proper test, nor did they care to continue any further, using the poor performance of the Detroiter as an excuse for anything or for quitting. After a lengthy and somewhat ill-tempered meeting with the men, Wilkins finally persuaded his pilot and mechanic to continue on. Wilkins would have, as he told me later, given almost anything to have Ben Nielsen fly the Detroiter. But as he had never flown a trimotor plane, nor one the size of the Fokker, this was out of the question. The Detroiter was loaded up, and with Major Lamphere at the controls, Sergeant Wisely as flight mechanic and co-pilot, Wilkins as navigator, they took off for Barrow. The trip being described in Wilkins' book, Flying the Arctic. The Detroiter was sitting on the lagoon at Barrow when I arrived from Beachy Point. Our Eskimo guide from Beachy Point to Barrow, when offered pay for his services, refused the money offered. But having seen our lead dog's performance on the trail, he wanted to buy him. As the expedition had no further use for the dogs, he was offered the whole team, including sled and harnesses. He said he could not possibly accept such a large gift for his minor service. After some bickering, he finally settled on the leader and two other dogs, also the sled. I have never seen a native as happy and proud as Joe, telling everyone at Barrow what a nice bunch of fellows we were. The rest of the team was given to some other natives in return for doing some odd jobs for us at Barrow. The weather at Barrow at this time being 0-0 as far as flying was concerned, contributed in no small way to reopen the discontent of the Wilkins flight crew. The one factor in Wilkins' favor at Barrow was that there was no other way to return to Fairbanks than to fly the trimotor back or wait for a boat to Nome in the fall. Captain Wilkins appointed me helper to Major Lamphere and Sergeant Wisely working on the trimotor Fokker. Prior to landing, the right engine had started to miss. This caused it to lag and would not turn up the required revolutions per minute, therefore not synchronizing with the other engines. Lamford there told me that he had to fight the controls in order to stay on the course for the last hour in the air. Wisely had removed the carburetor twice, and finding some residue in the bottom each time, cleaning and replacing the carburetor. Then he would call, "Axel, you hit the crank again." The right Werben engine being equipped with a starter operated by a hand crank, I would stand on a stepladder, turn the crank as fast as I could, outer contact,
Lamphere would turn the switch on, and 9 times out of 10, nothing would happen. After so many fruitless tries, my irons would refuse to work. Then someone else would try. This kept on all day and for several days. When we finally succeeded in starting the engine, it did not perform any better than the day the trimotor arrived at Barrow. Wilkins and his flight crew, not getting along, made it all the worse. Some days there was not a word spoken between Wilkins and the other two men. Working around the plane and also rooming with Lamphere and Wisely, I had a chance to hear both sides of the story, as Wilkins and I were now the best of friends. A few days before I arrived at Barrow, Amundsen and Nobile in the dirty boat Norge had passed Barrow a few miles offshore, having completed their flight across the North Pole. They were sighted at Barrow, and a native hunter out on the ice with his dog team came rushing into the village, all excited, telling about the big whale flying through space. It scared him so badly that he lay down on his bed, covering his head with a piece of deer skin. As soon as the monster had passed, he lost no time heading for home. He was ready to confess all his sins to anyone who would listen to them, thinking that his life on earth was at an end. Charlie Brower told me that when Wilkins made his first flight to Barrow, he flew over a native out on the tundra with his dog team, scaring the native so bad that he left his team and ran all the way to Barrow, about 12 miles, reaching the village ahead of his dogs. The weather started to clear some at Barrow. Wilkins became restless, the trimotor being in no shape to attempt a flight over the polar ice. His decision was to return to Fairbanks as soon as weather permitted. It was now close to the end of May, and the packed snow on the lagoon was softening up and would no longer support the heavy airplane. It was his first intent to fly all the expedition personnel back to Fairbanks. The snow on the lagoon varied from its depth of 6 inches to 18 inches. Someone came up with the brilliant suggestion that we clear a path down to the ice, 2 feet wide for each wheel, and one path 18 inches wide for the tail skid, making the trenches 1,500 feet long. No one had taken into consideration the fact that the two outboard engines were not synchronized, one turning about 200 RPM less than the other. We soon found out, after proceeding for about 500 feet, the plane plowed into the snow bank on the right side of the runway. Having received no damage, the plane was returned by manpower to the starting line. It was now decided to clear an area 60 feet wide and 1,200 feet long. We all agreed this was it. There should be no trouble taking off. Every Eskimo in Barrow and all the expedition personnel, including Captain Wilkins, turned to the giant task. Every shovel was rounded up at Barrow, boards, snowshoes, boxes, etc. All had a part in removing the snow. The job completed late in the evening, Wilkins thought he better wait till the morning for the takeoff. The next morning, the weather was good. Everybody connected with the expedition climbed in. The Fokker had started to lift slightly from the lagoon when we ran out of runway, hitting the snow at the end, this being about 18 inches deep. In addition, some snow from clearing their runway was piled up on the end. This snow had frozen hard during the night. And as the plane nosed up, one of the outboard propellers hit a hard spot, probably a chunk of ice, breaking 2 inches off the prop and splitting the wood for some 4 inches. The prop was removed, and Wilkins asked me to take it up to Charlie Brower, believing that Brower could repair it. I offered to help Brower, and we set to work. Trimming the broken end, we bound the splits with brass strips. We then cut the unbroken blade to the same length, adding brass strips and screws, balancing the prop on a large knife held in the vise. We would file some on one end and add a few brass screws or tack on the other end. This way, obtaining perfect balance. When tried the next morning, there was very little additional vibration in the engine. During the night, a strong wind had drifted a lot of snow onto the landing strip. This had to be removed before attempting a flight. We also lengthened the clearing another 300 feet, giving us 1,500 feet in all. We all agreed that if some of us stayed at Barrow for the summer, Wilkins' chances of safely taking off and reaching Fairbanks would be greatly increased. I, for one, having no great desire to travel over the Endicott Mountains in a crippled airplane, my feelings, I'm sure, being shared with some of the others. In the afternoon of June the 4th, Wilkins, Lamphere, Wisely, Sandy Smith, and Earl Rossman boarded the plane, everything except absolutely necessary items having been removed. Lamphere held the brakes against the strain of the engine at the start, and when the prop wash had subsided some, I lay down on the ice to watch the clearance at the other end of the runway should the Fokker become airborne. To our great surprise and relief, it cleared the snow at the end of the strip by about 2 feet. I am sure that if Waski, Anderson, and myself, the remaining members, could have obtained some beverage, there would have been some celebration. The New York Times, in order to cover the flight of the Nord across the pole, had dispatched a reporter by the name of Lyons and a radio operator by the name of Bundy up to Barrow early in the spring, having traveled by dog team up the coast. Being connected with another news media other than the one covering the Detroit Arctic expedition, Wilkins had informed us not to associate with them. They were two very nice fellows, and after Wilkins left, we spent many pleasant days and evenings together. After storing all the gear belonging to the expedition, we had nothing to do except to wait for the Revenue Cutter Bear, scheduled to arrive the first part of August, the bear being our means of returning to civilization or to Nome. One day, sitting round Brower's store, Charlie said, "Why don't you and Herb take a trip to Wainwright? Jim Allen is running the store there, and he will be tickled to death to have you for company for a month. You can return on the trading ship Charles Brower to Barrow, due here in July." We took him up on the deal at once. The shore ice was good for sled traveling, even though it was in the month of June. Charlie Brower made arrangements with the native and his dog team to take us, and 2 days later, we greeted Jim Allen at the Wainwright store. Jim was delighted to hear that we intended to await the arrival of the Brower before going back to Barrow. Jim was a great big paw and as good-natured as he was big. We felt that we had known him for a long time, hearing Charlie Brower speaking of him quite often. We made ourselves right at home, and Jim gave us the run of his place. Shortly after our arrival at Wainwright, the Eskimos killed a whale, and plans were made for a big celebration. The whale meat and muskox being brought in from the whaling camp was laid out on driftwood and boxes, and everyone in the village helped themselves to meat and muskox. After eating, there was Eskimo dances, blanket toss, Eskimo wrestling, and high kicking. The Eskimo wrestling differs somewhat from the white man's wrestling, as the two opponents grab each other in a bear hug and wrestle until one throws the other one on the ground, and pinning the shoulders to the ground does not mean a thing. In high kicking, the contestants kick with both feet at something suspended up in the air, sometimes higher than his head. He will kick with both feet at once, often reaching way above his head. Having learned my lesson eating muskox at Iqaluit, I did not partake in the feast, but I did enjoy the sports and the contests connected with the celebration. In July, the ice had moved out from the beach at Wainwright. The ice pack could be seen several miles off the coast. One day, a native entered the store informing Jim Allen that walrus had been spotted on the ice floes 4 miles offshore. As the men in the village were making preparations for a hunt, he was sent to the store to invite the two white boys to attend. Also, Jim Allen, should he like to go. Jim said that he was busy bailing furs and splitting out the stock for the arrival of the Brower and the resupply. He declined the invitation. Herb and I promised to help him with his work when we returned from the hunt, and then he agreed to go. We left in the morning in 4 Omiaks, 4 skin boats, powered with outboard motors, 8 men to each boat. Jim was elected captain of the boat we were riding in. Being a captain, he had the honor of firing the first shot when reaching the walrus herd. Jim went to some length, telling and impressing Herb and I of his supreme marksmanship. When within a half a mile of the herd, the motor was stopped, and the natives using paddles approached within 50 yards of the sleeping walrus. There was hundreds of them on the ice floes. In stalking walrus on the ice, real caution and quiet has to be maintained at all times. There is always a big bull acting as lookout. When this bull raises his head and looks around, all paddling stops, and all occupants of the boat remained absolutely still. As soon as the lookout laid down, the paddling was resumed. The Eskimos gave the sign that we were close enough, and all guns ready, Jim fired the first shot, followed by the rest of the hunters. It was the maddest scramble of huge mammals one can imagine, and a noise sounding like a tornado. One big bull headed for one of the skin boats being wounded and mad, he pushed a hole in the sides with his tusks. The boat was kept from sinking by one of the hunters plugging the hole with his foot. After things quieted down and the smoke cleared, we landed on the ice floe. Counting, we found 16 walruses killed. Later, two boats pursued two wounded bulls and succeeded in killing them, bringing the total to 18 walruses. The Eskimos started cutting up the carcasses at once, as all the meat could not be transported in our boats in one trip. It would be necessary to make several trips. In order to make a clean kill, the hunter must make a head or neck shot. If not, the walrus will take to the water, thus being lost. One of the boys pointed to a bullet hole in one of the carcasses, at least 4 feet back from the head. Jim Allen shot there, he said. He no can shoot. Not wanting to hurt Jim's feelings, I said nothing about his skill as a marksman. It did not take long to cut up enough meat to load our boats. Then someone called it time to eat lunch. Us white men, having brought some sandwiches, started to eat. Wondering if the natives had brought some lunch, I asked one of them. He said, no, lots of lunch here. Cutting open one of the stomachs of a walrus, they all dug in with their hands, scooping handfuls of the stuff into their mouths. I said to Jim, what in the world are they eating? Clams, he informed me. The stomachs are full of clams. When investigating, I discovered that the walrus stomach was indeed full of clams in various stages of decomposition. I dared Herb sample some of the apparent delicacy. Herb said he would if others came. I tried, and strange as it seemed, a little revolting to my taste at first, it was not too bad. Salt and pepper would have improved the dish considerably. We returned to the village with our heavy loaded boats late in the evening, leaving the boat of the kill on the ice. The next morning, we found the Bureau of Indian Affairs boat, the Boxer, anchored offshore. The captain offered his services to the natives in order to salvage the rest of the meat. I went along for the ride. The ship pulled up alongside the ice floe, and with the aid of the ship's winch, all the meat was hoisted on board in a short while. Helping Jim, we soon had his store and warehouses in shape for the arrival of the Brower. 3 miles south of Wainwright, there was a small trading post established by Rawls Amundsen. Having a large supply of merchandise left over from one of his Arctic expeditions, this trading post was built in order to dispose of the goods. It was operated by a man named Dick Hall. Having completed all the work around Jim Allen's store and nothing in particular to do, Herb and I decided to walk down for a visit. Here the Arctic trader's jealousy again came in evidence, Jim trying to discourage us from going. We promised to be back in a few hours and left. In the afternoon, one of those freak summer snowstorms came up, and it was impossible for us to return, having to spend the night with Dick Hall. Dick was a character if there ever was one. We sat up nearly all night listening to his stories. Dick had been a sailor before settling in the Arctic. He told us that as soon as his stock was depleted, he would leave for the south. that there would be no resupply. I never did see or hear of him again. When telling Jim about our visit and Dick's stories, Jim said, "Don't you believe anything he told you. He is the biggest liar in the Arctic." A few days later, the Charles Brower arrived. Bidding Wainwright goodbye, we returned to Point Barrow. While waiting for the Bear, the schooner Bay Shimo arrived at Barrow. The Bay Shimo, sailing under British flag, being the supply ship for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police east of the Canadian border, also handling supplies and furs for some of the Canadian traders in the Mackenzie River area. The hospitality of this ship was noted all along the Arctic coast, all the white people in the Arctic having a standing invitation for dinner and a party on board whenever or wherever the boat anchored. Herb and I and a short story writer by the name of Edna Wallace accepted the invitation, and what a party it turned out to be. There was absolutely nothing too good for us during our stay. A few years later, when returning from the trip east of Barrow, the Bay Shimo suffered the misfortune of being caught in the Arctic ice pack. The crew made their way to shore, having to abandon the ship and all the valuable cargo of furs and ivory. The Bay Shimo became the ghost ship of the Arctic for many years. Seen several times, salvage attempts were made in order to recover the valuable cargo, but I have no knowledge as to the success or failure of the salvage attempt. The ultimate fate of the gallant ship can only be surmised. My guess is that the ice loosened its grip on the hull, and the Bay Shimo joined the hundreds of other ships now resting on the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. A report reaching Nome several years after the disaster claimed that the Russians along the Siberian coast had stripped and salvaged everything usable and of any value. How much truth there is in the statement, I do not know, and therefore the final disappearance of the Bay Shimo still remains one of the Arctic mysteries. The Charles Brower, being a large vessel, had to anchor quite a distance out from the beach. The freight was lighted to shore in skin boats, then packed by the Eskimos to the store and warehouse. It was not surprising at times to see a small Eskimo carrying a box weighing twice his own weight. The Cutter Bear arrived at Barrow on August the 14th, 1926, in command of Captain Cochrane. Although I had spent a pleasant summer at Barrow and Wainwright, there was a longing in my heart to once more enjoy the luxuries of civilization. There being eight white people leaving Barrow, the accommodation on the Bear were somewhat crowded. His friend had arrived from Beachy Point with his schooner Orion, selling out his interest to Tony Edwardson. He had decided to quit the Arctic and return to Nome on the Cutter Bear. The crew on the Bear all slept in hammocks suspended from the ceiling, having no previous experience with this type of a bed. Retiring for the night was quite an undertaking. Watching the sailors, it looked real simple. They would jump up, landing crosswise of the hammock, keeping their balance, gradually move their feet and upper part of the body into the hammock. My first and many other tries failed. Jumping up, the darn thing would swing and flop over, leaving me hanging underneath. And sometimes in moving my body and legs, it would flop again, landing me hard on the floor. Of course, all the sailors on board the boat had gathered around, laughing their heads off. This made me all the more determined to master the art of sleeping in this incooperative so-called bunk. After once being settled in the hammock, I found it to be a real comfortable bed. When the ship rolled, which was often, the hammock remained stationary, differing from regular ship's bunks, where your body has a tendency to roll with the motion of the ship. This is the end of reel number 3. There'll be one reel following. This will complete the story.
Do a good job typing too. No mistakes.